Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Alan Levy's show on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for joining me once again. You can be listening to this live broadcast on Sunday evening, the 19th of November, or as an archive file. So either way, I hope you'll enjoy it. Should have a very interesting night tonight. We have two guests. We have David Leeson, and will be joining us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist, and we're going to talk to him. He'll be up first. And then we have Joel Keller, who's a freelance journalist, writes for The Times, Washington Post, some New Jersey magazines, and he also contributes to Huffington Post. So I'm excited about the two of them joining us tonight. And Amy Domestico from the Bull Doodle, who's been working with me on Blog Talk Radio basically around the clock, is joining me as well. So I'm looking forward to speaking to Amy and having her join us. So once again, thank you for joining me. I'm very excited to be here tonight. I just want to go over a couple of things before we get started on the show. I did a tally. We've been doing a fair number of interviews lately with different types of publications because we're trying to get the word out on Blog Talk Radio. Of course, we've launched only on August 1st, so it's quite new, and we've been growing rapidly, and we're very proud, actually, some of the feedback we've been getting. We're really elated with the feedback, actually. But what's interesting is that we just hit our 1,000th registered host signed up. We've had 1,000 people sign up to be hosts on Blog Talk Radio. So therefore, there are thousands of shows that are either scheduled to occur or in our archive, and I think that's an important milestone. So that's happening, and again, I want to thank everybody for participating and enjoying the website and coming here. In fact, we just hit on Alexa yesterday a rating of about 12,000, which is quite significant. Alexa is the rating system for websites, so we've been growing rapidly on that, and which is nice to see. Nice to see people are enjoying the site, and I'm so pleased and honored that we can bring it to you.
Alexa's like the Nielsen ratings for radio. Yeah.
Yeah, Amy, it's right. I mean, Alexa is like Nielsen. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many websites there are in the world. Probably
millions.
You know, like 10 million, millions and millions, I would guess. So we just hit 12,000, and so it's pretty exciting, but we really have a lot of room to grow, and we're very excited about it. Two quick things, and then we're going to bring David on. One is, and we're going to be sending an email out this week about MP3s. We've now completed the work on the MP3s, so therefore you'll be able to play music. The host can play some bumper music. They can play other music. Again, we've got to be cognizant of the copyright protection issues, but you know, independent musicians want to play their stuff on Blog Talk Radio, be interviewed, have other guests be interviewed, that's going to be available this week. And so that's good. And the other thing is that the player, we're going to be sending a player around so everyone can post a player on their blog and be able to have their archive shows listened to on their blog and not necessarily on Blog Talk Radio. All live shows will be on Blog Talk Radio, as this one is now, but the archive show can be played on your own blogs, and we'll be sending that around to you. Amy and Georgia will be helping out, and Bob, and we're excited about that. Anyway, enough of that housekeeping. Amy, how are you? Good?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. I'm good. Great. So my first guest tonight is David Leeson, and it's a real honor to have David join us. And I'm just going to give you a little bio and a little background. David was born in Abilene, Texas, and he's been a staff photographer for the Dallas Morning News since 1984. He covered the war in Iraq in 2003. He's been covering conflicts for many, many years, and we're going to talk about that. And he covered the war in Iraq as an embedded journalist attached to the U.S. Army 3rd Infantry Division, 3rd Brigade Combat Team, Task Force 2-69, armored out of Fort Benning, Georgia. Boy, that is a mouthful. We're going to find out about that. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, he won a Pulitzer. So we're very excited to have David here, and he is a Blog Talk Radio host. David, how are you this evening?
Hey, I'm doing great. Nice to talk with you, Alan, and thanks for having me on the show.
Great. My pleasure. I was very excited that you did a show on Blog Talk Radio, and I must admit, I knew your sister, you know, because she had been a Deb Leeson is also does a book on, what's the name, Between the Covers?
Between the Covers,
Wednesday, 8 o'clock,
Between the Covers. And she's done a great job, and we're getting a lot of authors coming in and doing book readings. And Deb's, we're really happy to have you here. And I saw, you know, I see all the hosts come in, and I saw that we had another Leeson, so I presumed, I presumed it was a family member. And little did I know that you have such a, you know, very fascinating background, highly acclaimed. And actually, before I knew that, and we'll get into your background and what you're doing, I listened to your show, the first one. It was real. I think it was your first show, and I listened to a lot of the shows, and it was late at night. I didn't know who you were, but I just listened to your show, and you would just, you spoke, no one called you. I think no one even knew you were on, and you just said, you were so comfortable. You were so at peace with yourself and your, the scene of your life.
Thank you.
And it just came across out of that show. And then I learned that you were, you know, you were Deb's brother, and then, you know, you did these other things. And I said, Amy, we have to have you on. So.
Oh, that's really nice.
Here you are.
Thanks to Amy as well. It's been a terrific inspiration and great encouragement also with my blogging and such. I think Amy and I got started on our blogs at about the same time. So
yeah, we did.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It's been a process for David with his blogs, and I'm sure he'll tell you about that. But when I first met David, when he was blogging, he would blog like I did about my family and so on and so forth, and he always would touch on this self-portrait thing that he had been doing. And you finally, what did you, worked up the courage to make it public and get it done and
right.
Yeah, and teach people about the process of what you go through when you're doing these.
And you played a role in that. I actually look back, and Alan, you were talking about some of the conflict coverage. One of the things that Amy discovered early on was that I had a lot that I could say, that I perhaps want to say, but have difficulty saying, particularly writing it down, because it's a very painful experience to actually go through some of those things that are stuck in my head. And Amy was always encouraging me to do it. And over time, it sort of evolved into a very strange outlet in the long run. But I guess that's blogging, isn't it?
Well,
Blog Talk Radio, which is even better. I was joking with my wife. I said, look, I can sit down and in 30 minutes, I can, like, run my mouth for 30 minutes and then put all this stuff out of my head.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
You realize that doing a single blog, when I write them, it's anywhere from 2 to 4 hours of effort.
And you don't get any feedback generally. I mean, you will at some point. Oh. People, of course, read it, but they can't comment at that moment. But certainly people can call you and ask questions and kind of inquire and kind of take the conversation in different directions that may be a bit more interesting.
And Alan, I got to tell you, it's really what's happening with me at Blog Talk Radio and on my blog and even in my career really points back to following your passion. I think I mentioned in a recent show on a BTR that, you know, that was what was important to me, was following my passion, doing what I think I need to be doing. And my hope is that the right person, not that a lot of people, I mean, it's lovely if a whole bunch of people come, but I've never been one to chase after the numbers. I'm chasing after one person who might simply tune in that night or might listen to an archive a radio show or who might stumble across one of my blogs, and that one person's life has changed as a result. And that's exactly the same thing that I did with photography as a photojournalist for many years. I wasn't after trying to take care of every reader at the Dallas Morning News or in the United States or around the world. I always thought about one person out there. And I thought, if I can have impact in one person's life, then I've been successful. If I can get someone, even for just a moment, to stop over their morning coffee or their breakfast cereal, and they see a photograph of mine in a newspaper, and if they just count their blessings, then I've done something. You know, and even better if it spurs them to action. And so I used to think, what if those photographs could actually make someone heal a broken relationship or reach out to someone with love or reach out to their children and say, you know, I love you and just pull them close, a little bit closer that day, then I've done something. And that's what it's all about. It's about reaching an individual. It's not about reaching masses. And the process, you know, somehow, miraculously, it does reach masses. But it's always kind of confusing to me how that works. I think it's just people to people, and it's about our relationships, and it's about actually reaching out for that one person. And I got to tell you real quickly an interesting story. I was talking before a group of mostly junior high students in San Antonio, Texas, about 2 years ago, and I was talking about the importance of reaching out and making a difference in people's lives, and that those things, you don't have to be a great traveling photojournalist. You don't have to be on Blog Talk Radio. You don't have to have a blog. You don't have to do all these great things. I mean, I think we fall into that trap of thinking that, you know, I have to do something fantastic for anything to happen. And I said, and yet, if I asked every one of you, if there was one person out there who has been most influential in your life, it's going to be someone that no one else probably knows. Maybe you're the only person who knows it. And I said, that's for good or ill. And then I encouraged them to tell someone they love them today, to reach out and touch someone. I said, it's the smile given at the right time. It's a touch given at the right moment. It's a hug that at a moment when someone needs it the most. Those things move the world one shovel at a time. You know, taking that big mountain and moving it to the sea, you know, the Bible talks about, you know, you can cast the, tell the mountain, I'm going to put you, move it to the ocean. Well, I always thought that, well, maybe I don't have that kind of faith. Maybe I can't do those kinds of monumental things, but I can certainly take one shovel to the ocean. And I think if we all pick up our shovels, we'll do that. But anyway, to the point, and I said it would be short, and it wasn't.
No, that's fine. No, I...
but I was literally, I was getting on the elevator after the speech, and these young ladies were on there, 13, 14, 15-year-old girls. And as I stepped off the elevator, I heard one of them yell out, I love you, and the elevator is going down. It's going, I love you. And I said, wow. And I was like, wow, I guess I still have it, you know.
Well,
and then I remembered what I'd said in my speech. That someone could make a difference by simply speaking out and saying, I love you, to somebody today. And you know what? It really did. I've been talking about that young lady. I don't know who she is. I mean, honestly, I have no recollection except for that there was this one person who listened to one of my talks and said that to me one day, and it literally affected my entire life from that day forward. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
And that's the power of one. It's the power of one person acting on passion with courage, and as I say in my blogs and my writing, with risk and dare, stepping out and doing something that is led by passion, to say, I love you.
And that, and you know, and I heard some of that, and again, why I thought, you know, you're really fascinating and love to, you talk, and I think people feel good about when themselves or life when they hear you. You really have a lot of passion. But Blog Talk Radio, when I thought about it, when I first started looking at blogs seriously, which is really only...
By the way, thank you for this new, what's the word I'm looking for? Medium.
Well,
for us to be able to express like that. I think it's very powerful, and I want to personally thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much for that. When I first started looking at blogs, and this isn't about me, this is about you tonight, but I'll briefly take one tangent, and I had written about this recently in Huffington, where my dad had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma for the third time, and I created a blog for him, and really the first time I'd ever blogged. I didn't really know much about it, you know, and I didn't spend much time reading them. I looked around, but I started one for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so powerful in what we were able to do with it, that when I went into started looking into the blogosphere and I started understanding what was going on and the sheer size of it, that there were 55 million blogs, or 50 million at the time, and they're growing 200,000 a day, but it's a world of have and have-nots.
Right.
And it's not a very fair environment. It's a difficult place. It's a great tool for people who have passions, but it's 100 have and 50 million have-not.
Right.
In terms of the reach. So I felt that when we created Blog Talk Radio, if you have one person listening to the show, or 10,000, it's for you.
Yeah.
It's fine. You have the platform. Every person that uses this can reach everyone anywhere.
Right.
So that's, and you had just picked up, you know, you had noted that, and I think it is a very individual thing, and it is important, one shovel at a time, or one listener at a time, or one person at a time, and I think that's what people should understand, at least about this medium, and again, about their blogs, and about their passions.
Exactly. If you think about it, I think for the most part, that's the way all blogs begin. Now, where they end up, I don't know. But I actually try and stay focused in that area, both in photography and my art, in blogging and Blog Talk Radio. I think, okay, I would love to, you know, come on, obviously it would be great to be like a famous artist in photography, you know. Lovely. What a lovely idea. I go to all the best parties and I have these great gallery openings. And, you know, those are lovely thoughts and ideas, but you know what? That's not the core of it. And actually, there was a saying that I kind of lived by for years. Is someone else said it, and I can't remember who it was. But and basically, the photographers who win, those photographers who achieve greatness, are not those who shoot to win, but those who win with what they shoot. In other words, you know, people, and I've seen it in my own career, people who have chased after those kinds of things, particularly in the creative arts, when you chase after it, so often I've seen people just fall by the wayside because, as I say, I think it's a combination of mission. The mission may be to succeed and to win, and, of course, I think everyone should hope for success. But, you know, we're talking about mission there. But if you don't have this enormous passion to combine with mission, then there's no fuel for it. You're not going to get anywhere.
Well, you're talking about your photography, and I've as preparing for this, I spent some time looking at your work and your Pulitzer Prize-winning work in Iraq, and some of the pictures there are just incredible. You, of course, I'm an amateur. I'd like to take photographs. I do feel when I do, I kind of frame a picture and I look at all four corners and I say, okay, that's what I'm going to be. That's what is. How am I filling the corners? But you have such an eye, and not only for the content and the frame, but the shading and some of the shots that I've seen. You know, Death of a Soldier and some of these other shots are just incredible. What? When did you get this? I mean, did you know when you were very young? You say, boy, one thing is to love something, and the other thing is to really do well at it.
Yeah, you know, honestly, the earliest motivation for doing anything really comes back to what our whole conversation is sort of centered around. It's about making a difference. And actually, for many years when I was just a young boy, I really believed that was going to be in politics. And the reason why is because they seem to be people who could literally make a difference for good or ill. You know, we talk about making a difference, and very often we forget that you can also make a difference for ill. So you have to be very keenly aware of that how am I going to use my abilities to make a difference in this world? And hopefully we'd all choose to make a positive change in the world, to actually bring good things to people's lives. So that was the earliest thing. But, you know, it actually goes back to there's a number of factors like anybody's story. I mean, it's not just one thing in my case. But I can think of something that in talking about change, I was sitting on a panel at Berkeley a year ago, with Don McCullen and Kathleen Leroy, who just passed away this year, both of them famous photographers, mostly for their work in Vietnam. Don McCullen, one of the greatest war photographers of all time. And he said something. Someone asked him, says, do you really think that you've made a difference? And here's this guy. He's 80 years old, I think, now, or nearing 80, 79 or something like that. And he says, no, I used to believe that, and I really wanted to believe that, but I can't say that I really believe it anymore. And it came time for me, you know, it was a panel discussion, and I said, well, Don, I said, you know, whenever I was maybe 12 years old, and I was just this boy in Abilene, Texas, I rode my bike to the library one day, and I stumbled across a book of yours from your photographs, and it affected me so deeply that I remembered you my entire life, and there were times throughout my career that I've raised my camera in some war zone, and I've seen your images before me. I said, so maybe you didn't stop all war you didn't make the difference maybe you hoped to make, but you made a difference in my life. And so I have to count him as one of the early factors in certainly getting my mind wrapped around the idea that a camera could actually affect someone's lives and, or someone's life. It was a pretty powerful moment for me to actually meet someone that had my first influence in photojournalism, Don McCullen, this famous war photographer, and actually be able to sit on a panel with him at Berkeley and be able to tell him the difference that he made in my life was a pretty powerful moment.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Now, you always focus on conflict, right? I mean, generally, and the Iran, you were in Nicaragua, I saw. And
that's right. Back to, my first assignment was my first war conflict assignment. I was on patrol with the Contras, when President Reagan called them freedom fighters, the FDN Contras, who were fighting against the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, the Sandinista regime that had just overthrown the Somoza regime back in the 80s in Nicaragua. So,
is that where the Blade of Grass story comes from?
The blade of grass, actually, when you're talking about a blog I wrote about being caught in a crossfire and encountering a blade of grass, and that was actually in Angola during the fight there. Because, when I was there in Angola, that poor nation had been at war for about 30 years. It was one of the longest running conflicts in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they've since ceased hostilities. I hope. All of these things are all kind of mixed together in my head because it's interesting. Right after that was Rwanda, and I was actually in South Africa at the time. And I remember people talking about how 300,000 people or some sort of outrageous figure had been killed in a week. And my news judgment was so deeply clouded at that time because I had just returned from Angola where 350,000, 400,000 people had died in a single year. And yet nobody noticed. I mean, it was just this hidden war that nobody seemed to pay any attention as to how many children were dying in Angola, and now we're all worked up about Rwanda. And, it was this terrible cynicism that took place, and here I was just, a few hours flight, maybe 3 or 4 hours away from Rwanda, and I could have gone and covered that story, and I didn't want to.
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible, the idealism that takes place? But there was there's a certain amount of truth to that, is that we focus on those big splashes and, the big news. And so often, really, photojournalism and the things that I've tried to do in my career are not about the splash in the pond, but the ripples that emanate from it.
Now, Scott Kesterson, as you know, of course, and he was on Blog Talk Radio. We had a show with him. I don't know if you had a chance to ever listen to any of that. He called in from Kandahar one evening, 4 in the morning.
Yes.
And we had a show, and it's now on our homepage, actually. We have it as one of the featured shows.
Right.
I thought it was really just fascinating that he was calling in from there, 4 in the morning, and we had him live here, and people have questions and so on.
Right.
But what I found, because we were just talking about the fact that he was in some very, very difficult positions, which I know you have been as well.
Right.
While soldiers are carrying guns, you're carrying a camera.
Correct.
How do you get through that? I mean, and I pose the same question to him, and I'd like to hear your response. I mean, take us through what goes through your mind in that.
I'm sure we would probably echo similar sentiments. As you may know, and but some of the listeners may not know, is that Scott is someone that actually encountered me at my blog, we became friends via email, and there was something different about Scott. He had a passion and a drive and ambition, and plus he just seemed deeply persistent. I mean, the guy is just really, he would not let go. And I admire those kinds of qualities, and so I continued the relationship. And what took place was, over a period of time, was, a guy who went from he had his company building outdoor garden structures in Portland, Oregon, which is certainly a fine business, but to me, it boggles my mind to think that a year ago, that's what he was doing, and now today he's been in Afghanistan for all this time, and he's doing some of the most important work in the world in photojournalism. So that's pretty amazing. It also speaks to the power of mentoring. It speaks to that very same thing we've talked about. I guess if this show had a theme, it would be about that interpersonal relationship and the tremendous power that can take place with people working with one another. But anyway, what goes through your mind? Actually, one of the things that I told Scott is that the camera actually functions like a shield. And certainly, in fact, it's probably led some photographers to their deaths, unfortunately, is to actually begin to believe that it truly is like a shield. But I think that sounds like, well, that's a lovely answer, but what's really behind that? As I explained to Scott, and I would explain here, is that the camera provides a purpose. It provides a mission. It provides a reason for being there. And, you know, when I first encountered that was actually in the invasion of Iraq. And I think I'd always known it but didn't really understand it until one day there was a mortar attack on where I was, and the bombs were falling, these mortar rounds, 155-millimeter mortars, and it was exploding in the kill zone, and it was not a good thing. I dove for cover, and I immediately, after it stopped, there was dust and smoke in the air, and I heard people yelling, is everyone okay? Is anybody hurt? And naturally, my role was to begin taking photographs, to begin recording this moment. So I reached for my camera, and it wasn't there. I couldn't find it. And I'm not particularly an obscene person. I tend to not be too profane. I certainly hope not. But I certainly had a string of profanities whenever I could not locate my camera. And I was terrified. Suddenly, I had lost my mission. This is what I came up with, because it shook me up for like 45 minutes to an hour, is that I had lost my mission. The camera provided me with the very reason why I would even suffer those risks. Without that camera, then why am I even there? What's the point? I mean, I'm not here. This isn't bungee jumping, which is funny because, you know, people think that, you know, this type A kind of personality, well, I think I have a lot of that, but I think there's a whole bunch of it. It's really not type A. It's just a guy who's very directed by his sense of mission about making a difference in the world. Because I've never bungee jumped, and I've got absolutely no interest in it. I've never skydived because I've got no interest in it. However, if part of my mission as a photojournalist were to skydive into Iraq, then I would probably do it. So I think that's really all that takes place, is that because that camera is so powerful, and actually I believe there's more wars. Let me back up and say, I think I have a very powerful weapon in my hand that can influence world opinion. And unfortunately, I believe that there's a lot of people out there, insurgents, and back in the old day, we used to just call them guerrillas. The fact is they know it as well. And that's one reason why the death toll in journalists has risen so steadily in the last decade. Because the people have finally figured it out. They understand that, is that people who have a camera in your hand, you're not just standing there without a gun. You actually have something very, very powerful. So, that's, you know, I never felt defenseless, I guess. And also, you have to understand something else, is that when you've made a decision to place yourself in the line of duty, in the line of fire, out of a sense of duty. And, you know, there's a saying that photographers say, no photograph is worth dying for. I'm not exactly sure about that, because you've got to understand that there's people like me who actually believe that our cameras could literally have the potential of stopping war, stopping injustice, of changing the face of society. And you have to imagine how many people's lives could be saved if I can get just that right photograph.
Well, the one in the Vietnam War, which was the most
famous. Well, the Vietnam War, Adams' photograph, right. or Nick Ut's photograph of the Napalm Girl. Both of those images, historians say, made a strong impact on stopping the war, of ending U.S. involvement in that war. Well, how many tens of thousands of lives were saved as a result of those photographs? Now, I would ask you, is your life worth that, giving of yourself like that? Well, of course it is. So I don't really buy it. I mean, that's not to say that I would foolishly go and stick my neck out on the line. But, you know, if there was a good reason, then, yeah, it's worth the risk. I mean, what do you think Scott Kesterson is doing? He's not over there trying to stay safe.
Yeah.
I mean, the man has put his – in fact, he had me worried. He sent his tape back from some of his combat footage, and I edited it here in Dallas, and it was astonishing. I actually chewed him out a little bit about it. I said, you know, dude – you know, risk is one thing, but what the hell were you doing when this happened? So I kind of raked him over the coals over some stuff.
Well, that's sometimes one needs that, I guess.
Yeah, he's a terrific man, though, and I have tremendous respect for him. And
he is amazing.
I'm glad you brought him up.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Speaking of Eddie Adams, you are an instructor at the Eddie Adams
workshop. That's right. I have for the last 2 years.
That's quite
the
an
Adams
honor.
Workshop.
Yeah, that's quite an honor.
Yeah, it is an honor. It's a lot of work. Unfortunately, I was not an instructor there when Eddie Adams was still alive, so I never got a chance to meet him. But to this day, it still draws some of the most famous photojournalists in the world still arrive there.
How do they pick the 100 that go to the workshop?
It's a portfolio process. These young photographers, everyone has to be within 3 years in the business. They don't have to be students, so you could have already started your job, but you haven't been a professional photographer, say, for 3 years or less. That's the determiner. And
we
have put a portfolio.
We have perhaps Joel's on. We have a. Would you mind?
Oh,
I'll bring perfect. Joel on. And,
please, no.
Great.
Absolutely.
I'll introduce you.
Yes.
Hi, you're on Blog Talk Radio?
Hey, it's Joel.
Hey, Joel. How are you?
I'm doing
Hi,
all
Joel.
Right. How are you doing?
This is David. How are you, sir?
David Leeson. Have you met Joel? And I guess, I don't know, Joel, have you had a chance to listen to the beginning of the show?
I have not. Unfortunately, I have not been able to listen to the beginning of the show.
Okay. I'm having dinner like I was right before the show, I guess.
Maybe. I think I was just busy trying to catch up on some of my writing, even though it's a Sunday night.
Well, it's excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. David is... is a Blog Talk Radio host, and he's a photojournalist, and he's covered Iraq and many conflicts, Katrina and some others, and won a Pulitzer Prize, in fact. When was that, by the way, David?
The Pulitzer?
Yes.
2004 is when it was.
2004. So about 15 minutes ago, he says, well, maybe, you know, I'm not really looking to become a famous journalist, you know, have accolades and the like. But, of course, winning a Pulitzer does kind of shine the resume just a bit.
Yeah, it was an honor to receive it. But, you know, interesting thing is we've been talking, Joel, about the impact of one person upon another person. You know, I'm not going to put words in your mouth because I wouldn't deem to do that, but my guess is most of the great writers I've known have often, they're writing to an individual, you know, not to great masses of people. And but the Pulitzer is... Whenever I was awarded that, one of the first things I did was I spent the next 4 days calling people that I felt like had been influential in my career and helped me at some point, even if they may have thought it was insignificant. So I tracked them down and I called them. Many of them old folks now, you know. I mean, they're retired and they've been out of the business for a while. And I gave them a call and I just wanted to let them know that Pulitzer was theirs, it wasn't mine. And I think that's the significant difference between that award and some of the others I've won, is that it truly does kind of stand apart, at least in my mind it did. And I felt like it's more of a career achievement. It certainly was for me. I'd been a finalist 4 times before I finally won. And I felt like the honor belonged to all those people who had poured so much into my lives over the years.
Thanks. Yeah, I've always felt. I mean, I haven't won any awards. Let's just say that. But I do feel like whenever a like I get a big assignment or an essay lands in a big magazine, I always like to thank the people that, you know, that helped me get there, that, that suggested that I send something out to this market, that I get in contact with an editor, help me with the essay. You know, people that helped me shape the essay or people that helped me decide what to write about in my more journalistic stuff. And, you know, it's not even out of a sense of obligation. It's more out of a sense of, look, without you guys, I wouldn't have been able to do this.
Right.
So, now, before we get in, you know, talk with Joel and get some of Joel's background and what he's working on, just want remind everyone, you're listening to live Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com. The archive file can be found at blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy. This is the Alan Levy Show. We'd like to take some calls for people, for either David or Joel, later on in the show, and you can call the show at 347-677-0649. That's 347-677-0649. And, Joel, thank you for joining us tonight. We followed some of your work, and I know that you've contributed to Huffington.
Yeah, for a little while.
Right, and we actually been doing some work with Huffington, and Ariana was a guest on our show, and she's great. I mean, she gave us a lot of her time, and we've both Amy and I, in fact, have contributed blog posts. We are amateurs, of course, but we've contributed blog posts, and I know you've done that, and you're New Jersey-based. You've contributed for the New York Times, some other New Jersey Monthly magazine. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can give us a sense of what you write about and your background and your passion for writing.
Well, a lot of what I write about involves stuff I like and stuff I love. I mean, a lot of what I wrote about when I was contributing to the New Jersey section of the New York Times, for instance, was about food. I wrote about greasy spoons and diners and taverns, dark taverns and dives and things like that for the little quick bite section. And I've also was able to profile a couple of people that I enjoyed watching on TV or listening to on the radio. They were very nice about giving me, you know, they were very nice about the ideas that I sent them, and especially with the food articles, they were very nice about saying yes to whatever little wacky place I wanted to write about. I also write about TV a lot. I write for this blog called TV Squad, which is owned by AOL, which is kind of my main gig right now. And that's great to be able to get paid to watch TV shows and then write about them. And then whenever news comes down the pike, I write about that kind of stuff. I write a lot of essays, a lot of which are tinged with humor. Some, like the last one that you guys saw that kind of led you to me, was one that was in November issue of Jane, which I tried to make funny, but apparently a lot of people thought was quite poignant.
Oh, that was a great piece.
Yeah.
For our audience, you can kind of talk about that piece a bit.
It's a piece that I wrote a couple of years ago for a class that I was taking in New York about writing the personal essay. I had written personal essays up to that point. A lot of them were humorous. A lot of them, you know, and they had been, you know, I'd seen there were a couple in Salon, the Jersey section of the Times published a couple, but I really wanted to find out how to write like the real deep personal stuff, not just stuff that was just light humorous essays that just happened to involve me. So I wrote this essay. It was about a office marriage or work marriage relationship that I was in about, you know, in the late 90s. And it basically, if you've ever watched The Office, you remember, and you know the characters Jim and Pam. It was kind of that relationship. And it was actually almost exactly that relationship because the woman was in a long-term relationship and she got engaged while we were working together, and we got along very well, and to the point where our chemistry was such that people thought, like waiters and waitresses thought that we were married. And the whole story is about how I dealt with it and how she dealt with it and how it kind of all fell apart at the end and really wasn't a pleasant ending.
It was how you perceived the relationship and how she perceived it were two totally different things.
Oh, yeah.
And it was I thought it was funny. And, of course, it was a little, you know, sad, of course, in the end, but it was a great story.
Yeah, it's the odd part about that is that that's one of those things I kind of, when I used to work in IT. That's part of my background. Mm-hmm. About 6 months ago, I took a leave of absence and decided to freelance write full time. And I'm probably going to continue that once the leave of absence is over. So, you know, when I wrote that piece, it was for that class, and it was the type of situation where I needed something to write that day. I had an assignment. So I was at work. You know, it was in the middle of the afternoon. Not much was going on. I was kind of bored, so I just kind of sat down and typed it. And usually it doesn't come out that easy. My essays usually are more considered, and I pour over things a little bit more, and I think about them more, whereas that one I just sat and typed it. And, you know, the version that ended up in the magazine isn't that much different than the version that I originally typed and brought to the class that day.
It's interesting, just thinking about contrast between what you're writing and David's taking photos, where you're really thinking through these things, apart from that essay, but where you're really kind of sculpting it and really looking at each word and really diving in. And it's interesting, and because David, as you're taking when you're shooting, you're taking a moment. It's impulsive. Maybe you can draw a distinction between the two, Joel. I mean, do you really delve into these projects that you have, and do you want to expand this into writing novels or getting into where do you see it going in terms of what you like to write?
Well, I mean, I'm not a professional photographer, but I definitely know that the type of photography I like to do is of-the-moment photography as well, where, you know, if you're on vacation or you're out somewhere, you see something, you pull out your camera and start taking pictures, and it's just so different than how I approach my writing. So I can see how a photojournalist would need to really just kind of take the whole thing in at once and try to figure out where he could position himself to get the shot that he needs. Whereas with me, I really can really pour over things and kind of maybe get some of the essay started in my head the proper way before I even sit down to write. I'm not the type of person who there's a school of thought that says just write, if you don't have a beginning, just write the rest of the essay and then come back and the beginning will come to you. I'm the type of person who, if I don't have a beginning of the essay doesn't get written even though I want to write it. Like, if I don't have a good way to begin it, I'm not going to write it because I'll just sit there and stare at the page and, you know, ponder that opening for, you know, for days and days.
I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I feel the same way.
But what I will say, though, is this essay, especially it getting published in a major publication like Jane, makes me think that either a book of essays or a memoir or even a novel, all of these are things that I've been kind of batting around in my head, might happen. I mean, it encourages me to maybe think of sitting down and taking some time and trying to figure out what project I want to do and how to go about, you know, getting someone to pay attention to it.
I have to tell you, as a professional photographer who is a voracious reader and absolutely adores writing, I'm one of those guys that you probably love just because I'll come across a single sentence written by someone and just marvel at it, the power and mastery of words. But, you know, I find that we're both after the same thing, and that is a moment. Except that in writing, so often the writer is actually creating that moment for me. They're sculpting it, and as opposed to me being able to just recognize it and see it. Of course, you have to do the same thing as well as a writer. I mean, obviously, you have to be very keen and have a lot of sensitivity to the moments in life in order for you to be able to write about them.
Right, and it's also about, you know, it's also about making sure the image I have in my head gets translated to the page so the person who's reading it can at least see a little bit of what I saw.
Exactly.
You know, I'm not saying that they're going to see exactly what I saw, and that's not the purpose of reading something, to see exactly what the writer saw. But you want them to get an idea of what you saw. You know, and that's where my process is a little bit on the purposeful kind of more, just kind of a more considered side, because I just have to make sure that I'm not talking over someone's head, or I'm not using words that I wouldn't use in a normal conversation, and just making sure that it's readable and conveys what I want to convey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, you know, sometimes it comes easy and sometimes it doesn't.
It's mastery over the craft as well, because, you know, honestly, standing with a camera, I think most people believe that it's, you know, just kind of happenstance, right place, right time. And certainly there's a lot of it that does exist like that. But by and large, most of the great photography is something that took many years to get to that place and to understand it and be able to use that camera in a proper way, to be able to speak with eloquence in a visual language.
Well, and in the case of photography, I'm sure the luck of being in the right place at the right time is also a product of years and years of knowing where to be.
Same with good writers.
Yeah.
Well, there was one picture that I saw of David with, which I thought was incredible, because and first of all, Joel, your website is joelkeller.com?
Yep.
Yeah. And David, what's your website?
DavidLeeson.com.
DavidLeeson.com.
You have a blog at davidjleeson.com. So.
Someone else had David Leeson?
No, I have davidleeson.com and
David J. Leeson, I see.
Right.
But there was a shot included in your blog or on davidleeson.com as a listing, the Pulitzer Prize winning photos, some of them, and then your favorite shots, which I love to look at. And it was the one shot with the boxer, with the Golden Glove boxer,
right,
waiting to go into the ring. Maybe just describe that for everybody for a moment.
Well, it's just a boxer waiting for his round, and he was in the back of the arena. But, you know, they have that little circular light very often above a boxing ring, and in the background it was there. And when I saw him with his arms outstretched across the backs of the seats, and I noticed that light above his head, suddenly, you know, he became quite angelic as I placed him and composed it so that the ring of lights from the boxing ring actually was above the man's
head. It was a halo. It was incredible.
It was a halo.
Really, you have to check out the site, and it's a halo.
It sounds a little schmaltzy, but you know, I'm not into that kind of photography. So trust me, you'll see if you go look at it.
Yeah,
it's not as stupid as it sounds.
No,
gimmicky. Maybe that's the word, because I don't particularly like gimmicky. Although I've certainly been prone to do it at times.
Right. So Joel, have you done much photography work, or more amateur?
Yeah, more amateur for myself. I mean, every time I go on vacation, I'll take tons and tons of pictures, and a lot of them, I make sure they're not just snapshots. A lot of them, I make sure I kind of frame them correctly, and you know, if I see a moment and I'm walking by, I'll stop and take a picture, someone on the street or something like that. It's not as considered and not as purposeful as someone, you know, with their camera sitting on staking out a street corner and shooting the scenes as they go by like a professional would.
Right.
But it's something where there have been times when I've been on vacation and I have my camera and I'll happenstance on something and take a good shot. But
now, if it's
not the same thing. So.
No, I understand. Now, if you have a piece that you feel is just incredible, and how does it work? Do you reach out to the New York Times and you feel this is a very important piece that needs that type of exposure? How does it work when you're a freelance journalist and you want to contribute to some of these, you know, significant publications? Maybe you can give us a little indication of how that works.
It really all depends on the type of piece. If it's a reported piece, like a profile or a newsy type piece, the process is to pitch the idea, to find an editor for the section that you want to pitch it to, usually not the main editor, usually one of the lower editors, because it's easier for them to kind of sell the article to their boss, and it makes them look good. But you pitch the idea, and you just have a query letter that says, you know, I'd like to write about so-and-so, and this is what he does, and here's the angle, and here's how it maybe connects with something going on in the news today, or maybe this celebrity has a movie or a book coming out, or he or she is a star of a TV show that's, you know, up and coming, or a hit TV show, something like that. And you know, and you just say, look, I really would like to profile this person, and just make sure you don't give a generic angle. Don't say, I'd like to profile Brian Williams of NBC News. You want to say, I want to profile Brian Williams of NBC News, and follow him around and really try to bring out the sense of humor he has, because he's very funny and he doesn't really show it during the news, that kind of thing. You want to try to kind of get an angle on the person. I want to profile, I don't know, I remember hearing about a story about Brad Pitt that was on like CBS Sunday Morning that had to do with something that he was collecting. He was a big collector of something unusual that I don't remember now, but that kind of thing. Like, try to get a unique angle.
And who would you like to put? Like, if you had to get that perfect shot, and I'm going to ask David, I would like to ask you this next, but Joel, if you wanted that interview, that killer interview, who would you want?
The killer interview, who would I want? You know, at this point, you know, to be honest, it really goes back to a person that I've admired since I was a kid and listened to his music for the longest time, is Billy Joel. I know it's kind of fluffy. He's, you know, and he's been interviewed before. It's not like he's that tough of a get, but he is a big deal interview. If you would happen, you know, you don't interview Billy Joel for the local newspaper, you know. So he'd be the guy that I'd want to talk to, first of all, for what how he's influenced my life from teenagehood, you know, up until through college, whatnot. And also just because I think he's led a very interesting life so far. You know, from the all the, you know, his wives getting progressively younger, to the hit songs, to his drinking problems from a few years ago and his car accidents, and living out in Long Island as a regular guy, kind of still acting like a regular guy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that you can delve into with him.
Well, Billy Joel, I grew up in Long Island myself, and I'm younger than him, not a bit younger. And the lead drummer of his band was Sal DeVito. He lived in Seaford, Long Island. And
yeah,
Billy Joel,
yeah.
So I grew up with this, and, you know, and the Ballad of Billy the Kid is one of my favorite songs of all time. But we have a call. Why don't we take a call and see who's on and see what they have to say. 325, you're on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Deb Leeson from Between the Covers.
Hi, Deb. How are you?
Hey.
Hi, Deb.
I'm really not Between the Covers, but that's my Blog Talk Radio show. I just got off from another show at your side, Alan, and I just wanted to call in and listen, basically, because I don't know what all y'all have been saying. I haven't been able to listen until now, but how did Billy Joel come up into the conversation?
Well, I asked Joel which would be the interview he really wanted to do. You know, that big interview that would just
right. The big one. Yeah.
Right. And so he said Billy Joel, and I think that's a great answer. I love Billy Joel growing up on Long Island, and I think that's good. And I was just about to get to pose the same question to your brother.
Very good. I'm glad I called in at the right time. Will you keep me on for a little bit?
Yeah, you could come on. We have a few more minutes. So, David, which is the shot? What's the shot you really would love to get?
Well, first off, I've got to say that, Joel, I was disappointed you didn't name me as the next killer. That's okay. You know, I'm going to let it go.
He just met you. He'll call you later.
I'm teasing, obviously.
I'll go to your website, and things may change after I see your photos.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They want to interview you on location, Dave.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I think it might be a bit too strange for, I don't know which publication would want it. But anyway, the point, actually for photographs, you know, it's interesting because the closest question to that is what's your favorite photograph you've ever made? And I've never been able to answer that because you almost have to specify, well, in what category? Because none of them, because they all kind of work in different ways. But I have to say that if there was one thing that has always always kind of been out there, the one thing I've never been able to do, never been able to accomplish, the one thing that so many other great photojournalists have far greater minds than mine have tried to do, and that is to find that single image or series of images that can literally stop injustice. And stop tyranny of war and the evils that beset our society. And I know that sounds like such a glib answer, and yet it's certainly a very genuine and sincere response, is that those are the images you're always chasing after as a photojournalist. That's the one image you want, so you never know exactly what it is. So it's really about placing yourself in the right place and the right time, and who can say what that is? So much of it comes down to fate and to, you know, your path in life, and, you know, you just hope for the best. But I don't really have any particular thing. I guess failing that, it would just be the next best photograph of my children. Or today, actually, I went out and shot photographs. I went on a walk in the Great Trinity Forest right here near downtown Dallas, the largest urban bottomland hardwood forest in the nation, if not the world, exists right on the outside edges of downtown Dallas, and almost nobody knows about it.
You ever want to take a picture that would survive, say, for, you know, like the Iwo Jima photo or the...
Well, yeah, of course. You're talking about those iconic images.
Yeah.
It's at the Eddie Adams workshop that Amy was talking about, where I was speaking up there, and there was a man who said, you know, the iconic image of Iraq hasn't been made yet, and perhaps it could be made at home. And I was thinking, because there in attendance was was this year's Pulitzer Prize winner who did that amazing study, Todd Heisler, of the unit that goes and notifies next of kin about the deaths of their husband or son or daughter. Tremendously gripping, rip your heart out portfolio. In fact, I've not seen his images because I personally, emotionally cannot deal with them. They're that strong. And I thought, there's some iconic images there. And of course, naturally, I thought of my own images and how the test of time will measure them. And in fact, interestingly enough, a New York Times writer doing a story on me and some Iraq work, ask the same question: what are the iconic photographs from Iraq? And everyone says, well, we don't know. I mean, no one's seen them yet. And honestly, I believe that if you think back, a great deal of the images that became icons didn't occur right then and there at that time in history. It's not as though they appear on our front page and we immediately say, oh, my God, there's the icon. It's something that grows with us. We become familiar with it. It becomes something that we've learned to live with. When we think about, the Kennedy assassination, I mean, what do we think of? John saluting or perhaps Oswald being shot. When we think about Vietnam, we think of Nick Utz's photograph or Eddie Adams' photograph, Nick Utz's photograph of the napalm girl or Eddie Adams with the Viet Cong suspect being shot. I mean, there's all these things, and, of course, Joe Rosenthal, you know, who died this year for his Iwo Jima photograph from World War II. So there's all these things, but when did those things actually become icons? You know, so we'll see.
Did you see the photo that was sent to me from that soldier in Afghanistan? It was of the women standing in line to vote. They had their burqas on, and you couldn't see their faces. And over the shoulder of one of the women was a child in this bright red dress, and the child had its head on the woman's shoulder, and she was sleeping. And it was these women, it was their first time standing in line to vote. That, to me, it was taken by a soldier.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing photo.
It's possible. It's possible, although I have to tell you, that's interesting. I don't want to get off track here, but be cautious of those "it was taken by a soldier" kind of comments, because my images have appeared in numerous publications that were brought in by soldiers claiming that they made the images. So, in fact, I had a piece that originated in Village Voice last year, a direct result of that, a soldier who had sold Village Voice on these images and his story. And it was some editor who actually said, "Wait a second, I think I've seen those images before," and did a little research and said, "Oh, my God, these don't belong to that guy at all."
But, yeah.
What I find interesting, though, is even after you make that iconic image, you still have to work. I mean, Nick Gutt made that image 35 years ago.
I just saw Nick Gutt 3 weeks ago, the first time I'd met him. He's a wonderful man, and you're right. He's still working.
I saw a
fact. I just thought of something. I had the most amazing thing. We've been talking about Nick Gutt and the Napalm Girl. She was there, too. So I met her. In fact, she came up to me after my presentation. She put her arms around me and gave me a kiss, and I kissed her back. And I thought, oh, I can't believe it. I felt like you were kissing history. I actually had my lips on the face, the cheek of this little girl in that photograph. Something
unbelievable.
But the funny thing is, I've also seen recent pictures that Nick Gutt has done of, like, celebrities, you know, like red carpet.
Oh, yeah, sure,
you know?
Of course.
I mean, because he still works for the AP, right? So
yes, that's correct. He does.
So that's what I mean. It's like, it's just funny that you can make that iconic image or you can write that, you know, essay or report.
Exactly, of course. I mean, life goes on.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about that image and actually the very basis of what creates that. I mean, how do these images come to be in the first place was really what started the whole self-portrait process that I did starting in 1982. And it was about finding out how images can take on a life of their own. And that was my goal, was to find out what is it about the creative process that can give life to a photograph so that it lives apart and separate from me. And can live on for ages, long after I'm dead. So that whole question, it's a difficult one for me to answer, and yet it's been central to a great deal of my life, and certainly my life and my career.
The alchemist.
Creative alchemist, right.
There you go.
So we have five people online, and four of which are Blog Talk Radio hosts, so... I think we may have to recruit Joel to become a Blog Talk Radio host soon.
Yeah, Joel, where's your show, man?
I've been trying to listen to a couple shows here and there. I listen to Ariana. I just want to, you know, it's funny. I wanted to find out from some of the other folks that you guys have recruited who, you know, what it entails and what they've been finding. Maybe
it's user friendly.
Yeah, I could tell that.
Just pick up the phone, man. Just pay for a show like at 2 in the morning like I do, and just do it. And here's the thing is, when I first did my first show, I didn't tell anyone. I just kind of went and did it in the middle of the night, practically. I think it started at midnight. And, of course, I had no listeners. I didn't expect to have any. In fact,
hey, wait a minute. I was there.
Oh, that's true, but I had problems, and I didn't know how to work the controls. So, but anyway, the point is that I did this show, and I always thought, well, I can delete it later if I don't like it.
Right. Well, no, it's just really just one of those things where I've always wanted to, you know, kind of do this type of thing, get on and talk and maybe play a little music or something like that. And obviously in the days of just terrestrial radio, there was no opportunity to do anything like that at all. There was a couple of public radio stations and college radio, and that's it. And that's dwindled over time. So something like this, especially when you make it easy, when you just have to call a number and talk into the phone, instead of having to man a mixing board and figure out the streaming and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, it makes it very tempting.
We have hosts. I'll give you an example. We picked up a host just this past week who we had approached to do a show about his business. Mm-hmm. And when he called me back, I had sent him an email. When he called me back, he said, "You know, I really would love to do a show about my business, but could I do a political show? I've always wanted to do that." And I said, "Of course you can. You can do whatever you want. It's Blog Talk Radio, you know." And so he came on. He did his first political show this past week. And now he's planning his show for his business and all that. But he's doing a show about something he totally just always wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
Amy's reaching out. We're speaking to a lot of different people. I mean, the thing about this is just, you know, you've got all type of demographics. We've got, you know, kids to 80-year-old businessmen and mm-hmm. every religion under the sun. But we've just worked out. Tell them about the Epilepsy Foundation and what we're doing there.
Yes, the Epilepsy Project, we reached out to them. I found them on StumbleUpon, actually. They are going to be coming on. The president and the co-founder and the chairman both have children who were untreatable with medication for epilepsy, so they created the Epilepsy Project along with FACES and epilepsy.com. And they're going to be coming on to do an interview. Then they're going to be doing a variety of shows on Blog Talk Radio. We've got ideas in the works for even a telethon, as far as a telethon goes with them. So for the nonprofits, Blog Talk Radio can be a huge, huge asset.
Right.
Right.
Right. I mean, and from what Alan has told me, the listeners are there. So
they are.
They're starting to come. So
right.
Everybody's got, you know, their pet cause, you know. Everybody has, you know, like mine would be for the animal rights, you know.
Speaking of animal rights, I actually have to appear before a grand jury in Louisiana next week. Can you believe that?
Oh, because of the dogs?
Yeah, the dog shooting thing.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm watching out my windows carefully now, you know.
Yeah, you know, and I'm going to make my exit because I realize all the lines are tied up, and I just wanted to wish you guys a great rest of the evening, and have a good interview and show, Alan and Amy, and it's nice to talk with you guys for a little bit.
Great. Thank you for calling.
And I'm going to, I'll get off now and open up a line for you.
Thank you.
Appreciate all right. Bye-bye. Bye, brother.
Thank you very much.
By the way, Alan, just to fill in a little detail, I remember you were mentioning like how else I like pitch articles. Essays are a little bit different, by the way. A lot of writers ask that question. It's like, well, with essays, do I pitch them like I pitch an article, or with essays you got to write them. You got to write them and send them in full with like a two-line cover letter saying I wrote this essay. You know, research the market, know that they take essays and say, I wrote this essay. I think it would be great for your magazine or for your section of your magazine. Read it and let me know what you think. And that's it. And basically, it's a lot. It's free writing. It's writing on spec. But that's the only way you can do it most of the time, because they have to figure out what your voice is. And the only way to do that is to send them the essay instead of pitching them the idea.
I think that, you know, one of the things about Huffington, which seems to be great, is that you can send that piece over to them and they'll post it on their site. And you know, it does get, you know, Huffington Post has got tremendous exposure.
Yeah, Huffington's interesting because, can I let out a little bit of a trade secret on the air right now?
Sure.
They don't pay.
Right, of course.
Right, yeah.
And which, as a freelance writer, is a little bit of a concern to me. But what I like about it is that it is in the form of a blog. I mean, it's using using movable type. It's using a blog format where you can just go in, type it. Now, one of the Eat the Press editor there, Rachel Sklar, is the one who introduced me to, you know, she's the one that I was able to contact and get onto there. So she would edit my posts before they went live, which slowed down the process a little bit, but it still is a matter of, just like any other blog, you type it in the blogging system, you hit send or you hit post, and it gets published immediately. There's no waiting around to position it. There's no holding on to it. You know, it's just an opinion article, and you hit send, and it's there immediately.
Right. Now, David, you blog. How often do you blog?
Oh, well, it depends. Depends on how busy I am.
You go in spurts.
Yeah, I go in spurts. The thing is, Alan, is that it's the same with Blog Talk Radio, is that I'm not trying to be a blogger. I'm not trying to be a radio guy. I have something I'd like to share, and so I share it whenever I feel like I can share it. And people who come, they come. If they don't come, that's okay. I'm not after big numbers. If they come, that's great. If they don't, you know, it the strangest thing, Alan, is sitting around doing these radio shows, and I've only had one caller, and it was my sister. she was my first time caller, and the only one actually. And I'm sitting here in a room at my house talking to what appeared to be nobody for 30 minutes straight with my mouth running.
Well, I can tell you that we were all listening, but you are so passionate in what you're talking about that nobody wanted to interrupt you with
a call. Nobody wants to jump in.
No, because you really have a lot to say, and we wanted to hear what you had to say. Because I was laying in bed listening myself on my laptop, and I'm like, I should get up and call, but I don't want to miss anything, you know?
Well, most people actually on Blog Talk Radio, most shows are downloaded and listened to at a later time.
Right.
They're put into iTunes, they're archived, they're subscribed.
Right.
And so on. So
I just feel like it's whoever comes, and that's great. And I think that's what makes me a little bit different in this area is that this is let's be honest. I don't need any of this in order to help me with my career or anything else. I mean, in that sense, I have a great luxury. I've certainly built a very strong career in my area of interest, photojournalism. I've spent 30 years doing that, and so anything I do is just simply things. I like to think of them as they're really more about mentoring. I do a great deal of mentoring, and I feel like that there's something that I can give back, and if someone stumbles across that and their lives are affected by it, then hey, that's just great. And then, like I said, one person listens to the show and it was the right person. But I will tell you this, is that I have gotten feedback from people who send me emails from the shows, and quite literally some of them have said those very kinds of words to me, that you changed my life.
Yeah,
that's powerful stuff, because you realize that it does make a difference in people's lives. It doesn't, and it didn't take 5,000 people for a time.
Well, one of the things that we've learned, too, and we have this one of the top hosts, and the top shows here, by the way, are running in the thousands a week of downloads. Just, you know, and for them, they started, it was 50, 60, 100 downloads, and, you know, now there are 2,000. So
sure. They're
growing. But this one, Awesome Zara, she's one of the fourth or fifth, and Amy knows Awesome Zara. She writes, she's a MySpace blogger. She has, I don't know, a couple of thousand subscribers to her blog on MySpace. Sure. One of the top MySpace bloggers, top five generally.
Yeah, she's got a real smarmy personality, so she's very sarcastic and funny. So
she's really good. So she comes on and she does a show, and what she found interesting about it was that the people that have commented in her blog for these years that she's gotten to know but never spoke to, she can now speak to them and hear their voice.
Right, yeah. Well, I've been using Blog Talk Radio as a way often, at least two out of the – I've only done four shows now. So two out of the four, though, have been keyed off of one of the blogs I've done. And it's interesting because I write very more poetically. In other words, I'm not as direct in my writing, and it's just my writing style, at least for my blogs. But by the way, Joel, I don't consider myself a writer. You know, I also play the piano, so to speak, but I don't call myself a pianist either. So you're in no danger here. I didn't think you were too worried, though.
I'm not.
Okay, good.
Hey, a couple of years ago, I didn't consider myself a writer either. So.
Okay.
You know,
well, anyway,
But
actually, I'm actually using that as a way and to be able to expound upon those things, and actually in the spoken language, that I'm very direct about those things, and I think it helps. It's already helped illustrate a lot of the things I was trying to say. Of course, you know, you kind of hope that people are getting that message anyway. But then again, I never claimed to be a writer, so.
See, for me, the Blog Talk Radio idea is interesting. I'm someone who's still trying to establish himself. I mean, I'm on my way, but it's still a work in progress. And to me, this is an interesting way to build my platform. But since it's a new venture, really, it's just what the hell, let me see how it goes type of idea. I've always wanted to talk on the radio, and you know, and what? Why not? Who knows? It might go. It might do great. It might go somewhere, or it might just be me talking to 20 people, and that'll be it. But I just figured, you know, it's to me, it's just a matter of it's a new thing to try.
Right.
I think if things go as we think, and some of the feedback we've gotten from, you know, many different types of people, and Amy and I get it all the time. I mean, from the Epilepsy Foundation, the Los Angeles Fire Department hosts shows on Blog Talk Radio. We are speaking to people of all different types of areas of interest. At some point, this will be a viable platform, and one which will bring a lot of traffic, and one where people are going to come here and listen to engaging conversation.
Sure.
And when that happens, like, I think, you know, those that are participating will have that platform. Again, if it's one or it's 10,000 listening, you have the ability to do it. So
The RSS subscribe area there on the side is really smart stuff. I clicked on mine for iTunes, and sure enough, now everything I do on my show ends up in my iTunes, which ends up on my iPod, which is really cool.
Have you registered with the iTunes account?
Oh yeah, yeah, I have one.
See, well, you have an iTunes, but what we're doing, and we're working this out, and Joel, just so you know, is that we are subscribing all these podcasts. These live shows are podcasts,
right?
And they're subscribed, and we are focused now on becoming a featured provider on iTunes, which is the largest podcast directory in the world.
Right.
Right.
So when we have more, you know, this week we downloaded about 75,000 shows in total of all the shows on Blog Talk Radio, remarkably. Mm. When we become a featured provider, and we hope to, and the way we'll do it is by all the hosts getting accounts, and Amy has the details on that, and Bob, we're going to send that out again this week. But that's when the numbers will also grow, because people will go on the iTunes store and podcast and find Blog Talk Radio as a feature provider. Here are the hosts by genre.
Oh, yeah, very cool.
Yeah, it's writing. So that's our objective. So the RSS feed is functional and it works, but really the key for us is getting to be a featured provider.
Yeah.
And, again, the podcasting space, I'm having a dialogue with a number of journalists now about podcasting, because podcasting, in my view, is an industry that's new, but it's one that's got significant problems, traditional broadcasting. So we have another call, so let's see if we can take that. And
when do you guys talk? I don't want to.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? You're on Blog Talk Radio? 248? Hello? Hello? Yeah, hi.
Hello?
You're on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi.
Yes, hi, 248, you're on Blog Talk Radio.
This is Lewis.
Hi, Lewis,
yeah,
how are you?
Doing okay, yourself?
Great, thank you. You have a question for Joel or David tonight?
Yeah, I was actually wanting to talk to Joel a little bit and find out how Sister Helen's doing.
Funny. Never heard that joke before, ever.
Never.
We got a prank
caller.
It would have worked better had it been a little bit better delivered, but I'm off my game tonight, so I apologize.
Yeah, okay.
Never heard that joke before in my life, ever.
Yeah. That generally doesn't happen, so. Anyway.
Was that a prank call?
I think so.
I'm sorry, but I missed the joke.
I did, too. What happened there?
That's good. And, yeah, Joel, you never heard that, of course.
Yeah, it's the old joke. Anybody whose last name is Keller is like, "How's your sister Helen?"
Oh, you're kidding me!
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Oh.
That takes me back to.
Okay. Well, Joel, I thanks for filling me in, because I'm sorry I never heard that one.
That one takes me back to about fourth grade.
Yeah, that's about as bad as why did the chicken cross the road? I'm gonna wish you guys a wonderful night. And Joel, it was really great talking to you again. David, as usual, always a pleasure.
Yeah, we're gonna wrap this up.
Yep.
And by the way, before we go, because I think we could all wrap this up, what a pathetic life one must have. If they have to call Blog Talk Radio on this show, you know, an hour into the show and make a lame Helen Keller joke. I mean, that's...
It's not even a good enough prank call to show up on Howard Stern the next day or anything like that.
Right, that's right.
You know you've made it when you're getting prank calls.
Yeah, when I'm getting prank calls, you know, I'll tell you, we're hitting the mainstream. But, Amy, before you go, let me just say thank you to Joel. I appreciate it, and you know, if in fact you want to come on and kind of test out the waters, we're here to help, and we'd love to have you and use it to have guests and interview, and it's fun, it's enjoyable, and you know, you see where it goes, and so thank you for joining us tonight.
No, Alan, thanks for inviting me. It was fun.
Good. And David, you're a really amazing guy, I have to say, and I'm really happy that I was able to speak with you and learn more about it. And I'd love to just hear your shows. You do them at 2 in the morning or whenever. We'll listen to them later. I got them in my iTunes. They're on my iTunes. I've subscribed to your show. And
terrific.
It's an honor to know you, and you're an inspiration. You should really speak out more because you touch a lot of people in a very positive way.
I appreciate that. Thanks. And, Joel, it's a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, pleasure meeting
you.
Very
great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You've listened to Alan Levy's show on Blog Talk Radio. It was a great night. Joel Keller and David Leeson and Amy Domestico joined me. Once again, thank you for joining me, and be well.